Oh, sorry, yes, of course.
So the first panel session then, using games for educational purposes, Phil will lead off, and then Colonel Eva Heilman will follow on after that, and then it could be time for questions and answers.
Okay, thanks very much, Graham. You see here the books, which between them, particularly Simulating War, lay out my own personal experience of using war games educationally in a whole variety of different ways. That is unusual, it's unrepresentative for most of the people here. You're not academics, most of you. You're concerned with professional uses. You're concerned, for example, with contemporary conflicts or future conflicts, rather than, as my gaming has tended to be, with historical conflicts and using war games to understand those. I'm going to try and make my remarks as generic as possible, but inevitably I'll be referring quite a bit to my own experience. Please take that as an example of a much larger universe, which is exactly what Graham said. Okay. I'll just make points under three headings. What I'm not going to be doing this morning is, as I usually do in these presentations, addressing the downside, addressing the many problems. We've got a whole session tomorrow in which we're going to be going through a litany of problems. I'm not saying we should put off the discussion until then, but at least in terms of my presentation, I'm going to accentuate the positive at the moment. Okay. So what can war games offer? The first thing, creating appropriate games. I'll say most about this. And the problems of involvement and accessibility from the perspective of education. And then I'll close, if it works, which I hope it will, with a case study about one of the things which I cover in my courses, air combat tactics, and how I'm planning to develop my course, and I'll give you a little example of that to close. Okay, so what can war games offer in an educational context, including, of course, military education? You know, of course, how important games are as an analogue of war. I'm always quoting Clausewitz to this effect, and just worth looking at that. In the whole range of human affairs, it's a game he chooses as something that's closest to the experience of war. Look back, of course, in that book, 1987 Strategy, the exception in the brackets there illustrates how he thinks there's something really special about war you don't find in civilian life, except for warlike games. Yeah? So he's making this same point. There's something about games which artificially captures the dynamic interactivity, the antagonism, which is characteristic of conflict, but which we don't thankfully experience in most of our day-to-day lives to anything like the same extent. So what can war games offer? There's not a definition of wargaming, but something trying to summarise, in my words, what wargames offer to us. Some key words, they're safe. I mean, one of the key points about wargaming, why you wargame, is that you want to learn lessons without actually getting shot, without the downsides of war. It reflects some of the dynamics, not all by any means, some of the situational dynamics, the modelling of the capabilities and so on, the terrain, some of the decision dynamics. Now that first sentence could actually apply to a book. A book is a safe, vicarious reflection of warfare. You know, it's nothing like war, but it tries to say something about war. So war games, you need to push the identification a little bit further. And that's what I tried to do in the second sentence there. Interactive modelling, systematic. You've actually got to construct a framework, whereas if you're writing a book, for example, you can focus on one thing or another. You don't need to provide anything which stands up altogether. Focus on the hypothetical possibilities, not on telling a story of what happened, but creating an environment in which multiple things can happen, but only a very limited set of conflict dynamics. You look at traditional verbal analyses, be it in a lecture, be it in an article, be it in a book. It's much broader, more eclectic. It goes all the way from the experience of Joe on the front line right up to what the president was doing across all the levels of war. And it focuses on what actually happened, not what might have happened. Okay. This is a diagram from my Simulating War book. which illustrates, particularly in terms of historical war games, I think, that distinction. The book will tend to focus on the historical story. This is just a graph showing victory, basically, and the likelihood of the outcome. What war games do is say, well, that was only one game. If we were to play this many times, if we were to able to have multiple alternate universes, what would the distribution of outcomes look like? And there's various different distributions shown there. Is it very determinist? Is it very, very chaotic, etc.? That's the sort of thing that war games try and give you insight into, the hypothetical rather than just this is what happened, all that matters is what actually happened on the day. I think the key word, as far as educational value of war games are concerned, the key two words, is active learning or active learning. This, of course, is seen as a very good thing by most educationalists. Rather than sitting and passively absorbing information, you get people to take part themselves. You get them to speak for themselves, to think for themselves, to question, to interact. Okay. Many, many forms of active learning, and I use plenty of them myself. Seminars, of course, are a classic one. Presentations by students, debates between groups of students. All of these are good ways in which you can get people to think for themselves, to talk for themselves, rather than just be told by you what the wisdom is. What I think is particularly useful about wargaming is that it goes beyond that. And I don't see the education that wargames provide as being, in any sense, I will educate you. It is a learning experience for all of those, including those running the wargames, including the facilitators, including the teachers, including particularly the game designers. When they play their game, when they see their game being played with others, they get insights. In books, you can write what you like, and the book's page isn't going to scream out to you, this is nonsense. You design a war game badly, and it is. We were just talking about it at dinner last night. The famous case that Richard Berg's design of the Panzergruppe Guderian didn't work. Why? Because they got the terrain wrong. And they only realized they got the terrain wrong, copied it from Destruction of Armour Group Centre, the Donegan game earlier, because the game didn't work. You know, the forces didn't go where they were supposed to, because it didn't make sense, because there were forests in the wrong places. Yeah? War games argue back. Failed models are successful models. Willard McCarty, a colleague of mine here, made that point. Models work best when they fail, because they force you to question the assumptions which you put into the model, and to revise it, and so on. Okay? So you see those points later on. And very importantly, of course, within an educational environment, you can't just take it as read that you're succeeding in this. You need to get the feedback from not only the games, but the students. And there's a couple of examples of people from some of my MA courses talking about the differences that they've experienced between other modules, more traditional modules, and this particular one where they're designing a game on a conflict of their choice. Okay, so I think there's a hell of a lot that war games can offer. No time to go into lots more detail on that. There's somewhat more in the book, of course. Let me move on to the second and the main area that I wanted to cover this morning, creating appropriate games. Because we have an enormous menu of choice. Here are just some of the main variables when one has the thought of using a war game. Obviously, what's the topic? What conflict are you actually going to war game? What level is it going to be? Tactical, strategic, political, military? Okay. So what's the subject and the focus of the game? Are you going to codify the rules? And of course, the possibilities range all the way from free Kriegspiel, or perhaps the ultimate free Kriegspiel, let's just get together in a seminar room and talk about it, the Bogsat approach, a bunch of guys sat around a table. That, in some definitions, is a war game, and is bringing up some of the same issues. No rules involved, you're just talking about the dynamics of a past or a potential conflict. Yeah? At one extreme, all the way, of course, to the hobby-style war game where there's no umpires, everything is codified within the rules, and rather like chess, as long as you observe the rules, you'll know who's won at the end, regardless of any disagreements between the players. So the codification of the rules is very important, and of course that's a key area where military war games in particular tend to operate in that middle ground. A lot of things with very little codification of rules, the Bogsat approach, quite a lot where the umpire has a lot of discretion, or the team of umpires, rather than full codification and doing away with umpires. Number of participants, again, very, very variable. Plenty of war games that can be played by one person, that are designed to be played by one person, computer especially. others that are played by one person, taking both sides in turn to get some of the interactive dynamics. Two people, and then all the way up to massive multiplayer, either online or in military contexts. Size and complexity. All the way from literally the back of a postcard war game, the back and front of a postcard, the maps on the front, and the rules and counters are on the back, to quite inordinately complex things, which even the designers couldn't play to completion because it would take years. And then the form of representation, and Graham alluded to this. A war game is not tied to a particular means of operation. There are plenty of war games, including my own, that can be played through different means. You can play them with counters on a map. You can play them with little miniature figures on little model battlefields. You can play them on a computer screen. Yeah? But it's the same system. Not all games, of course, are as flexible as that. Some are dedicated to particular approaches. But one of the key choices that need to be made is what mechanism, what means are you going to use for the end of the game? And there, of course, is Peter's book, which, as Graham said, lays all this out far better than I ever could. There's a range of choice. So how do we choose? Good military principle, what are we trying to do? What's the objective? In educational terms, what is the learning objective? That in particular is going to affect the topic of the game. Though, that doesn't mean that you can't use a particular topic for very, very diverse purposes. This is the first two slides I stole from Uwe's previous presentation. These are people who are using a game of ancient battles, similar to, they're not the same as my own. In my case, I want my students to understand something about the tactics and strategy of ancient warfare. In Uwe's case, he wants a contest, the further away from the present, the better, as a leadership exercise. Yeah? So topics are not unique as to the particular learning objectives that you want. What you need to do, though, is to decide beforehand, what am I trying to do here, and then choose the game accordingly. So learning objectives, I think, are prime. Constraints. Constraints of time and resources. Very important. You'd like to do this in a particular way, but you haven't got a week. You've got 2 hours. You'd like to do it with multiple network computers, but you can't afford it. So you've got to cut your coat according to your cloth. So you're planning within very severe constraints, and the resources, of course, and resources also in terms of the number of people who are available. There's some further constraints that I'll come to later on. Can you make use of things that have already been created rather than starting from scratch? There are huge numbers, many, many thousands of existing war game designs. Plenty of video game type things. And as you see there, just some from my collection, enormous numbers over the years, over the decades, board war games. Now those are just the publicly available ones. Of course, militaries will have available their own archive of war game systems that have been developed. Can you use those? Are they appropriate? Can you just take them off the shelf? Can you adapt them? Are they adaptable? That Call of Duty, for example, is not very adaptable. So unless you want to just play it as it is, it's going to be a hell of a coding problem to use. Others may be more adaptable. Board games will tend to be more adaptable. The problem with all of them, particularly, I have to say, the manual games, is they tend to be produced for people who have more time and more expertise in the minutiae of this than you do. So most of these existing designs, in my experience, are going to be more useful as models to imitate than they are as things to take off the shelf and run. There are some that one can use, some simple games, and Uwe will be talking more about this in his presentation. But for the most part, I find myself using existing designs, either for my own designs or for my students' designs, as here's something I can lend you, have a look at how it's been done much more complex, in a much more complex format, much more detailed format. Now I want you effectively to produce a game, precy, on the same battle. So it forms, if you like, a library of sources to lend to people so that they can produce their own much more manageable game. It's not just the time that you got in the class, how much time have you got? As educators, how much expertise have you got to be able to create a game from scratch particularly, or to run a game even? The picture shows me a few months ago in Budapest. I got an email inviting me to the Central European University to give a talk on my reconstructions of ancient battle. You see the chap there on the right and his students. And this is an academic who was very taken with my approach and had tried, just from reading the book and reading the deluxe game version of my Lost Battles system, tried to run it for himself. Not a wargamer. He tried to run it from scratch, just on the basis of the instructions. He'd done pretty well, but not well enough, let's put it that way. These things are very, very hard for most people to get their head around, something I'll probably be coming back to tomorrow. So how much time and expertise do you have, and do your team have, to design games and to operate them? Again, it's this matter of cutting your coat according to your cloth. Pros and cons of different game formats. It's often assumed, this book you may be familiar with, Roger Smith from 2009, tends to assume that all military games now, all serious games, are now computerized. Board games are ancient history. That's true to an extent within the military context. It's certainly not true in the recreational context, nor indeed within the military one, if you knew a bit better. And surprisingly, perhaps, despite people as eminent as Dunnigan proclaiming the death of board war gaming over the past 20 or 30 years, that is a graph showing the number of different board game designs that have been published over the last decade, and you'll see it's tripled. So we have a lot of different game formats available. There are pros and cons of the different ones. Essentially, computer games, I'll say more about this later on tomorrow, computer games will tend to take less time to play, they will tend to be more accessible to players. Manual games, on the other hand, are much more accessible for adaptability, for the designers to make input, they're much cheaper to operate, and they allow you to progress from playing to designing and to modifying much, much more easily than if you try and do the same with computer code, unless you're a computer whiz. That's just two of the game formats. There's plenty of other game formats we'll be hearing about. Matrix gaming, I've mentioned seminar gaming, and so on. So there's a whole range of different formats one can adopt. You need to look at that. Let me just close this section with a few quick trade-offs. One is between focus and abstraction. In order to fit within constraints, you're going to need to make sacrifices. You're going to need to focus in on the things you really want the game to address and abstract out, simplify the things that you can't afford to focus on. I used to use Craig Taylor's game Bomber in class to give students a sense of the dynamics of escort fighter range, particularly in raids against Germany in 1944. Fine, but I only got about a quarter of the way into the game, even within a two-hour class. So gradually over the years, more and more cuts were made to the point where I produced this game myself, which is like a very much cut down version of Bomber. Certain rules have been ditched altogether, radically simplified, particularly those about intelligence and planning. Forces have been amalgamated so that each of those counters now represents about 100 aircraft versus maybe 20 or 30 in the original game, just so that now finally we can play through a whole raid. Yeah. So you need to focus in, you need to abstract, you need to blur the detail in order to be able to fit within the constraints. Another trade-off I talk a lot about in the book, the command simulation versus the working model. A typical military war game seems as though it's focused very much on the command simulation idea, and you see there the classic blue, red in different rooms with the control and the umpire. That's one model, but actually it's only one model and may not be the best model for many purposes. I tend to emphasize instead the working model from the God's eye perspective, that the players are not surrogate commanders. The players are more like counterfactual historians, in my case, tinkering with, looking at the dynamics of what actually happened. Even the generals are assets to be employed. I've shown the Roman Invicta game, which started with a student designed by Garrett Mills, and Hannibal is hardwired into the system. You don't require the Carthaginian player to be as clever as Hannibal. The strengths of Hannibal and the weaknesses are hardwired into the system. Instead, what the players are looking at is the dynamics of battle avoidance, of politics versus military losses and so on. Bottom-up versus top-down modelling, VBS2 illustrated there, and then a simulation that I've produced of urban warfare. Obviously the one on the left looks far, far better, and you think, well, this is the real thing, and the other thing is just like something out of ancient history. On the other hand, remember what I said right at the start about war games by definition are safe. No, they're not actually. If you count gladiator games as war games, they're not. The kind of war games we play now are safe, but war isn't. So actually, if you put avatars in and they're shooting around and they're not really being killed and they're not at risk of being killed, they may not behave as accurately as they would in real life because the stakes simply are not there. Something that you may well be able to capture through top-down modelling where you say, when you're fired on, you're suppressed. Sorry, you can't just get up and keep firing and get your head blown off because you're too terrified and the commanders have to cope with that, you see? So this notion of bottom-up always being better, just get the ballistics right and everything else follows, isn't necessarily true because you're not capturing one of the key elements, which is human behaviour, in the context of mortal peril, by definition, in safe war games. Okay, just a few quick remarks about involvement and accessibility, and then the case study. Dunnigan's very pessimistic, or quite pessimistic in the book, about how many people can really grasp manual war game concepts. Even to play them, let alone to do more than that. I'm perhaps a little more hopeful than him, but only a little. These things are hard, and it tends to be a select group, many of whom are in this room, who are enthusiasts for this kind of approach, and others just see it as impossibly difficult to tackle. Now, what you're trying to do with war games is involve, as I said, through active learning, this whole body of students and teachers and so on. So this is important. How are you going to get over that problem? Again, a trade-off. You can make games which are really simple. There's one there, a strategic game, 200 years of the Mediterranean conflicts, which can be played in half an hour, and which I actually leave, it's called Empire, and I leave my students, after explaining the rules to them, to run it in teams for themselves, with me just looking in if they need any help. Okay. What you're losing often by making very quick, very simple games is the decision input. It's almost as if the game is running on rails. There's little that these people have to decide. There's little real choice. The obvious thing to do is X. You haven't got Y, Z, and all these other subtleties in order to keep it simple. Now, the more that you introduce choices, I could do this, I could do this. What could I do with my supplies? What about this? You see, all, the more that you introduce dilemmas, the more realistic it becomes, the more involved the players become in the decisions, but the A, the harder it is for them to understand the system, and B, the longer it's going to take. The furthest I've been able to go is the one you see there, Hell's Gate. Just about possible to be run in a two-hour class with help for the students. They're facing many more design decisions, but of course far less than the typical war game player would like, with hundreds of counters and thousands of hexes and so on. There's a problem with staff-student ratios. The students are not going to be war game experts. There's more students than there are of you. How are you going to tackle that? In a lecture, it's fine. There's 70 odd people in this room, it could be 400. You'd all hear, you know, you'd all be able to see in a properly designed lecture room. That's fine. When you're using war games, that ratio issue is much, much harder to overcome. You see there again, Uwe, with a small group of people, and he himself and his team indeed are personally involved. I have tried to run war games, a single war game, with a group of 30 students. As you might predict, some people, what the hell are we doing here? You know, we can't have any meaningful input. So in other words, this involvement issue is not just how many decisions are there to be made by the players, but how many players are there relative to the games. Huh? I've now moved to a system, and you see there on the left, whereby we have students in groups of about 8, and I use my MA students actually as teaching assistants, as force multipliers, to be able to run the games. But these are the kind of things. You can run much more demanding games, manual games particularly, using this approach of guided competition, because the people who really need to know what's going on are the teachers. The student will be instructed. If you're going to go to letting students play independently, and I have done this, you really need to get it simple. I have played games at the staff college with every single student playing against one other student, essentially on their own, and that's 400 students. But it needs to be something as simple as this, which is gotcha, it's almost like a slightly developed form of battleships. Yeah? If you're going to trust the students to be able to run it, including foreign students and so on, and you're nowhere near, you really, really need to dumb down. So there is this tension. How many decisions, how many meaningful decisions are there to be made within the game, and how many people are playing an individual game? These are difficult problems. Dunnigan's point, which I emphasized throughout the book, if you can play them, you can design them. Very important. For manual games, once you've got to the point that you can play them, which is hard, it's not too far to say, well, can I tweak this rule? Yeah, just rewrite it. Test it, you see? And then you get into design. Lee's here, actually. Where's Lee? There you go. Lee produced this game, Night Fighter. It needed an umpire. I saw, well, a very good game, but I'd like to play a solitaire. And so I'm just going to design my own solitaire system so that it can be played solitaire. Showed it to him, he liked it, and we published it on the line as an add-on. You see, there's a perfect example of how you can move from playing to designing. What you see there is, on the right, designed by some of my students. So, at first they have problems even playing games like this. By the end of the course, they have designed games like this. Stephen, who's sitting there, is one of my former students, for example. And in fact, that's one of your games, isn't it? By chance, I didn't do that deliberately. The game on Bautzen there. The other point, of course, is that if you really want students to be able to do it easily, there are some, not all, but some topics which can be approached through computer games. And can be picked up and played. And these are not just games which are designed for the enthusiasts, of course. All of them have this military link and are used as military training. It tends to be the case, of course, with first-person shooter type games. Much harder for war games, and indeed computer war games tend to be just as complex and just as long as board war games. But at the strategic level. But you can actually make them so that the interface and the software makes them much more accessible for play, not for design. Okay, very quick case study, because time's going on air combat tactics. One of the things that I do is teach a course, third year MBA course, on fighting in the air. I use various approaches in that. I use manual. I've shown you the Big Wig simulation. There's a grand tactical simulation there of fighter operations. But I also, of course, use real-time computer simulations to illustrate things like the advantages of a more spread-out finger four formation for intervisibility within a fighter group compared to, say, the old RAF fix. Always looking for new ways to proceed here. And one of the things that I found just over this summer, is a freeware simulation, actually a freeware flight simulation by a very clever little designer. It's called YS Flight. You can download it for yourself. It's very adaptable, fortunately. Many mods have been created for it. And what it allows you to do is to set up particularly one-on-one dogfights. Let me just show you how that works. So, low flight. And finish with this. Okay. What I've done here is record a quick 2-minute dogfight between two World War I fighters. So I've played it myself. All you need for this, by the way, this is just a £200 used computer, no special graphics card, anything like that, joystick, and that's it. That's important, because what I intend to do with this is to actually let the students download this for themselves off the course website and use it in their own time. So that really is the ideal. You don't even need to be in the class. You can experiment with this in your own time. Okay? Let me just play it and... Okay. So here we are. This is the kind of view the students would get as they're going along, flying in the Sopwith Camel, looking around, using the joystick, trying to find the enemy. I'll now put it to the view so that we can see where the enemy is. Okay, so this is looking out from your own plane. And the point is, of course, this is saved routinely. Head-on pass, and of course, at any point, then, during the review, one can pause it, one can look around, change the views so that you can make points about the different tactics that are being adopted, one circle versus two circle fights and so on. It's a damn sight better than just waving your hands around. We continue at this time. So this shows you some of the strengths of the computer, particularly in a real-time first-person environment. Compared to manual games, on which we're going to be focusing for a lot of the demonstrations later on. Okay. In the past, I've used much better simulations than this, but ones which need to be played on good computers in my room. The difference here is this is something the students can experiment with on their own. They can set up their own matchings, and they can actually network it so that you could have students in both of these planes. Or, just as usefully, you could have two students on the same side flying against artificial intelligence opponents, which this opponent is, practicing formation tactics. Yeah? So it's looking at what's out there, in this case an existing design, being able to adapt it, being able to use it for a particular purpose. Don't know how it's going to go, I haven't used it yet. It, of course, starts later this month. But giving you a sense of how it would work, and as I say, just going quickly into, there's the German view, there's the British view as we close in. One thing, for example, it's showing is how difficult it is in World War I biplanes, because the enemy keeps disappearing behind the wing. There we are, I think, and that's a good point at which to stop. So. Thanks for that. Hope you've enjoyed that quick overview. You're now here for Move 8, and then hopefully plenty of time for questions. Thanks.